99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we are continuing our multiple series here on central banks. Are they at the end of their ropes? And we've looked at some of the early history of the U.S. Federal Reserve, and we started talking about 1913-14, the origins of the Federal Reserve, how private bankers were really behind creating the Federal Reserve and why they did so after a century of opposing it, having a central bank. All right, we're going to come back to that thread and particularly talk about how the private banking system captured the Federal Reserve. In fact, they didn't capture it, they created it. And why they created it and how they exercised control over it in its early origins after 1913, and how that private banking system influence and control still exists today. That's the thrust of today's show. But before we get to that history, it's, I think, of some interest to talk about the recent Federal Reserve rate hike here of a few days ago. We'll see some of the themes are related. Okay, so Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed, had a press conference after the Fed agreed once again to raise short-term interest rates by another 0.25%, from 1 to 1.25%. Okay, that's the a third increase in about 6 months. There was a 0.25% hike in March, another 0.25% before that. So it appears the Fed is now on a track of raising rates. Now, the Federal Reserve, all along for years, particularly since 2010, has said that the reason they're raising rates, interest rates, and by the way, these are short-term interest rates, Fed has no control over long-term rates. That's general economic conditions. They're raising short-term rates in order to stimulate the economy and get price increases for goods and services up at least 2%. Now, they've been saying this for 8 years now, that the primary target, the objective of monetary policy by the Federal Reserve has been to stimulate the economy and get interest rates rising as a result. By stimulating the economy, theoretically, prices will then rise. And the target for the Fed has been this 2% increase in inflation, as measured by one of the select indexes called the PCE, Personal Consumptions Expenditures Index. You see, there's several price indexes, and the Fed doesn't use the Consumer Price Index or the GDP index. It uses this thing called the PCE. Well, you know, they've been saying for 8 years that they need to pump all this money into the economy through quantitative easing and other traditional methods, open market operations, so forth. And they've pumped somewhere between 10 and 15 trillion, conservatively, into the economy of money, money supply creation. That money supply creation drove interest rates down to zero levels, virtually, for bankers. Right? Bankers have gotten free money from the Federal Reserve for 8 years because of this massive injection of money into the economy, which is supposed to generate inflation. Well, it hasn't generated inflation. No, goods and services have been near zero, 1%, 1.5%, whatever. Their 2% price target for inflation has never been attained, despite tens of trillions of dollars. You see, this is one of the fictions of mainstream economics, that excess money is what drives goods and services inflation. And, well, you got $15 trillion of excess money injected into the economy and no inflation. So the historical record pretty much disproves that fiction, that it's money that creates inflation. But nonetheless, the Federal Reserve has kept that 2% price target as its objective and justification, excuse, for pumping all this free money into the banks and into investors' pockets. And banks and investors have gotten filthy rich because of the free money. How free is it? Well, for years, until just the last 6 months, bankers have been able to borrow at 0.1% as a result of Fed actions, Federal Reserve Bank actions here, pumping trillions of dollars. 0.1%. And of course, they go out and they loan the money to other investors, you know, at 3%, 4%, 5%, who knows? You know, it depends who's borrowing it. And that spread is the source of significant profits. Now, it's not the only profits for banks. Banks make profits a lot of ways, not just on the spread, interest rate spread, you know, what they pay to borrow the money from the Fed and what they then loan it out as. That's called the spread. They make money through fees and charging fees of all kinds and so forth. And they also make money by investing that money themselves into financial markets. Stock market, bond markets, and so forth. They're speculators. Banks are speculators. And they make probably more money that way than they do because of the interest rate spread. There's lots of ways they make money. But the point is, they get this free money from the Federal Reserve at 0.1%, called the federal funds rate. And the Federal Reserve then says to them, well, if you're not going to use that free money, virtually free money, right away, then park it with us here at the Federal Reserve, and we'll pay you a quarter of 1%. So the banks for years were able to borrow at 0.1% and not use the money and park it with the Fed and get an extra 0.15% free money. You see, not only free money, but you're going to get to make money off of the free money. You don't pay us anything for it, right? And but we're going to pay you for not using it. Well, isn't that crazy logic? Yes, but that's been the case for 8 years. Okay, so free money from zero interest rates. It's called the zero-bound interest rate program. And a quantitative easing program, you see, all that pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, drove interest rates down to near zero, and the banks have been making it hand over fist as a result. You see, the banks were bailed out in 2010. I mean, totally. They, you know, all their losses, except for a few of them that were chronically bankrupt and still are technically insolvent, you know, like Citigroup and for a while, Bank of America, right? They wouldn't let those banks fail because they were too big. They were all bailed out and making huge profits as of 2010. Right? So why did they continue for 8 more years of providing free money to the banks? You've got to answer that question. You know, why did the Fed continue QE, quantitative easing, free money, pumping it in there, buying up the bad non-returning loans and assets and bonds of private investors and banks? You know, it bought them at virtually above market prices, so it subsidized those investors, bought their bad assets for them, pumped all those free money in so they could fatten up their balance sheets, banks' balance sheets, and make all these profits. And why did they continue it for 8 years when the banks were bailed out in 2010? Well, they don't talk about that, do they? Well, that's because the whole idea of the Federal Reserve since 2008-09 in the crash has been to subsidize the private banking system. In other words, undertake a number of measures that would boost their profits artificially, not from being competitive and earning money and so forth. It's giving them money in various ways to boost their profits. The central bank, the Federal Reserve, and other major central banks now have this policy since 2008-09 of subsidizing the private banking system. Subsidizing meaning, we're going to make sure you make money. We're going to make it easy for you. We're going to give it to you, whatever. And, that was so lucrative for the banks, they got addicted to it. They're addicted to free money. And politically, because of their influences within the Bush, Obama, and now Trump administrations, the policy was just continued. Yeah. So, there's a politics here. We talk about the financialization of the economy, in other words, banks and financial institutions getting preferential arrangements for the last couple of decades. Well, we've had a financialization of the political system as well. You know, in the 1990s, it was Citigroup and its bankers that ran the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, and other government institutions. And then, of course, under George W. Bush, he appointed head of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, CEO for the big investment bank, Goldman Sachs. And that started the Goldman Sachs era, see, because Citigroup blew it and lost a lot and became bankrupt as a result of the crash. But Citigroup still exercised significant influence. In the Obama administration, reportedly they gave a list of recommendations for Obama in 2008 to hire as his cabinet, and Obama hired every one of them. That was Citigroup, right? At the same time, Goldman Sachs was increasing, deepening its influence within the government. And ever since then, we see Goldman Sachs providing millions of dollars in speech fees to Hillary Clinton, and at the same time, deepening its relationships with the Trump administration. Well, look at the Trump administration. Who's running the economy in the Trump administration? It's Goldman Sachs. It's government by Goldman Sachs. And foreign policy, government by the generals. And Trump, sits up there doing his tweets, and then they run him out once in a while in front of the public and so forth. He's a figurehead, right? He has some say in it all, don't get me wrong, and most of the say causes the ruling elite all kind of fits. But, he's not running the show. It's the bankers and generals who are running the show. And he gets in the way. He stumbles along and, generates issues and so forth that they got to cover up, et cetera. Well, I don't want to talk about Trump. I've talked about him already on this. But the point is Goldman Sachs. Steve Mnuchin is a Goldman Sachs employee. He's running the Treasury now. And this guy, Gary Cohn, former president of Goldman Sachs, was brought in to be the director of the Council of Economic Advisors for Trump. And now he's first in line to replace current Fed chairman Janet Yellen next January. Yeah, Gary Cohn will be, Goldman Sachs will run the Fed and Goldman Sachs will run the U.S. Treasury. Now, don't tell me this is not government, economic government by Goldman Sachs. And they're in all the kind of positions, secondary, third, tertiary level government positions as well. Okay. We just got to keep that in mind when we talk about why have the banks been subsidized so massively by the Federal Reserve. That's the primary function now of the Federal Reserve, to keep subsidizing the private banking system. And when necessary, they get in over their heads to bail them out. They call that lender of last resort function of the central bank, the Federal Reserve. Bailouts. primary purpose of the Federal Reserve. That's why the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, as we talked about last week. The private bankers, after the 1907-08 financial crash, got together because it looked like war in Europe and there might be more financial instability. They quietly went offshore to J.P. Morgan's retreat called, on Jekyll Island in North Carolina, and they secretly developed the proposal for the Federal Reserve. And then they came back, and it wasn't so secret once they came back. You know, they had a major politician's friends who then helped them push it through Congress. And when they pushed that bill through Congress, they created a Federal Reserve that was run by and for the private banks. The private banks designed the Federal Reserve, and the private banks then ran the Federal Reserve. How did they run it? Well, they created these 12 districts called Federal Reserve districts, where the bankers in each of those districts became the committee, the decision-making committee in those district banks. It wasn't run out of Washington. And the Federal Reserve District in New York became the operating command center of the Federal Reserve. That's a phrase, by the way, operating command center of the Federal Reserve system. That was a direct quote from Tim Geithner, who was the president of the New York Fed here under the crisis and then became Treasury Secretary, and now works for Warburg Pincus, a big equity firm, Warburg Pincus, private equity firm. You see, there's a big revolving doors between the Fed and the private banks. That's another indication that it's really run and controlled by the private banks. What happened to Ben Bernanke, right? Well, he went off, and now he's a big consultant making speeches to the banks. And he's a director, you know, for the big hedge fund, Citadel. Yeah, they get rewarded nicely if they do what the banks want them to do when they're in the Federal Reserve. They get these nice fat jobs afterwards, you see. Revolving doors. And, you know, goes both directions. He's getting filthy rich, Ben Bernanke now. Now gives $200,000 speeches to bankers. Well, they're paying them off. This is how it occurs, you see. It's all quite legal. The corruption in the U.S. is all quite legal. Okay, so we have this situation of the Federal Reserve subsidizing the private banks for 8 years now with super low interest rates. Well, now Janet Yellen and the Fed starting to raise interest rates. Because 8 years of low interest rates, while it's fattened the banks, has limits to it. You know, it causes other disruptions and other problems in the system, you see. So now they're trying to reverse course a little bit. Also, the reason why we got rates going back up is the Federal Reserve realizes another recession's coming, and they got to raise rates because they got no tools. If the rates are zero, you see, they'll have to bail out the banks again, and that means they got to give them free money again. Well, if your interest rates are already zero, you can't lower them anymore. Actually, you can. That's called negative interest rates. The Europeans and Japanese are doing it. But you can't do that very much, very low, negative. But the point is, the Fed is also preparing for the next recession by trying to get rates up there a little bit. You know, on average, every 7 years, we have a recession. Well, this is 8 years since the last one, so the next one's coming pretty soon. Next couple of years, I've been predicting. Okay, so they're raising rates a little bit here. They can't raise them very high, in my opinion, because the economy is very weak. I've been talking about that, the real economy. and raising rates is going to precipitate a faster contraction of the real economy if they raise them too high too fast. They can't raise them very high, you know. And I predict that this is the last rate increase here at 1.25% for the federal fund short-term rate that the Fed influences. It's not going to go any higher, because if it goes higher, it's going to trip an already very weak U.S. economy into a recession. So they're tiptoeing here into these rate increases, and they pretty much reached the max, I think. Okay, so the Fed says, going back to the Janet Yellen's recent increase here, the Fed says that they, and has been saying for 8 years, that the reason for Fed policy is to hit the target of 2% goods inflation, real goods and services inflation, not inflation in terms of financial assets, stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth. Not that inflation. That has been inflationary, right? We got bubbles in the stock and bond markets, and have had, and speculative derivatives markets and so forth. So it's true that the excess money pumped into the system by the Fed generates inflation, but it doesn't generate goods inflation. It generates financial asset inflation and bubbles, but they don't talk about that. Right. The Fed is only concerned. It's not concerned how big of bubbles that they create in financial assets, stocks, and bonds. They're concerned only with goods inflation, things you and I buy, you say. And the Fed says, well, we are going to be data-driven. Whatever the data tells us is what our policies are going to follow. Now, Janet Yellen said that, well, we're pretty close to our 2% inflation target, and that's why we're going to raise interest rates again, which they just did this past week. Well, that's not true. That's not true. The Fed has never been achieving its 2% target. It's never done that. And now it's done that even less, but still it's raising interest rates. PCE for April is only 1.7%, below the 2% target. And all kinds of indications are that prices and wages are weakening even more so. The reports just came out before the Fed announced its rate hike that the economy was weakening, that inflation was slowing, and yet Yellen said, well, inflation is rising, and we're going to raise rates. Well, actually, she did not say inflation was rising. What she said was the very low inflation that's being reported is due to one-off events. In other words, we have low, slowing inflation in the U.S. Because the cell phone contract prices and prescription drugs have declined in recent months, the prices for that in recent months. In other words, it's one-off, bro. You know, prices are going to rise again, right? So do you really think that cell phone contracts are behind why prices are slowing in the U.S., which means the economy is getting weaker? No, I don't believe that, right? And I don't believe prescription drug prices have declined either. You know, just go to your drugstore. Have the prices decline? I don't believe so. Okay. Now, Yellen said that the economic outlook is improving. Well, we had a 1% GDP growth rate here in the first quarter, actually less, recently adjusted the 1%, and say, oh, you know, well, the second quarter is going to be much better. We got consumer spending going again. Well, not in the last month, we haven't. We've got business investment increasing. Well, bank lending is down. And if you watch what's happening in the auto industry, big contraction coming. And raising rates will slow down the housing sector. Oh, well, but exports are doing good, according to Janet. Well, that's because of a short-term stimulus here by China in the last 6 months, which is coming to an end, and because currency declines in Europe have stimulated their exports. In other words, this is not a permanent fundamental basis for either arguing the economy outlook is positive because exports are rising or business or consumer spending is rising. No. Well, she points to unemployment, right? Unemployment is down to 4.3%. Ooh, that means a strong labor market, you know, which means, the economy must be doing good, right? We're averaging 160,000 jobs a month. Well, first of all, that 160,000 is declining, slowing, in other words. And the 4.3% is really full-time employees, full-time workers. You know, we have tens of millions, maybe 50 million, of unemployed and part-time employed, called contingent workers. They're not in that 4.3% figure. If you added all of that and improved the way, you know, the government actually estimates unemployment because it's very conservative, we're really still, 9-10% unemployment. Okay, so there are jobs that can't be filled. Well, those are high-skilled jobs, and we destroyed our job training, and businesses abandoned job training decades ago. So we got all these people who can't fulfill these high-paid, high-skilled jobs, the only niche in which the economy is actually producing jobs. Everywhere else is producing part-time temp jobs, low-paid jobs. If you look at other indicators, like the employment population ratio, collapsed in 2010 and has not improved and still is not improving. In other words, that ratio says, are we creating jobs at the rate the population is growing? Well, we're not, or we're creating far less. In other words, Fed and Yellen cherry pick whatever data they want, manipulate, spin it however they want to make it look like it's a justification for the policies that they adopt. But that doesn't mean that that's what the real world is actually doing. They're raising the rates because 8 years of low rates have been creating imbalances. You know, very low interest rates have, as I said, boosted profits of banks and investors, but has taken money out of the hands of grandma and grandpa as their fixed retirement incomes produce nothing, virtually nothing. CDs, savings accounts, nothing. In other words, there's been no income gain from fixed incomes for median retired families in 8 years. They've lost trillions of dollars in fixed income, retirement income gains, trillions, while the banks have added trillions. So in effect, they're taking the banks and the Fed low interest rate policy is taking money out of grandma and grandpa's pocket. And it's also undermining the retirement system, the institutional retirement system, pension funds and insurance companies that provide annuities, they're in deep doo-doo, and they may collapse. Well, certainly if we have another recession, you're going to see pension funds, big ones, states. Well, already some states have problems with their pension funds, Illinois and elsewhere, right? Big problems are going to, and people are going to lose their retirements next recession. Well, that's because of Fed policies here, subsidizing the banks at the expense of grandma, grandpa, and other institutional elements in the economy. Right? That's the consequence of this QE and all this free money. Well, they know that these pressures have been growing, so they're trying to back off of it, and at the same time, as I said before, trying to get themselves a little cushion for the next recession. And the Fed justifies it by misrepresenting the data. And they say they're data-driven, right? They're not data-driven, and there's 2% PCE inflation rate is a fiction. It's never really been something real that they orient to in terms of their policy. Their policy is all about subsidizing the banks. You know, it's not about raising prices to 2%. And they make it sound like it's very complicated, you know, and make it sound like only technicians and economists and bureaucrats can really know what's going on at the Federal Reserve. Well, that's why the Federal Reserve was created, you see, as a buffer. As a buffer from public opinion. In 1907-08, the government had to bail out the banks, the Treasury at the time, because there was no Federal Reserve. So the Treasury had to intervene and provide money to big bankers like J.P. Morgan and others, Paul Warburg and so forth, you know, to bail themselves out, which they did. But, you know, that kind of bailout has political repercussions. You know, it looks like the banks create a crisis, which they do, and then the politicians bail them out, but don't bail out the rest. Sound familiar? That's exactly what happened in 2008-09. Right? Well, it goes back to 1907-08, when the Federal Reserve bailed them out. Well, it wasn't the Federal Reserve, excuse me, it was the U.S. Treasury bailed them out. And the bankers, you know, it makes them look bad, like they're getting all the, you know, free money from the government, from the elected politicians. And the politicians don't like it because, you know, that causes, you know, election heartburn for them. Makes them easy targets that they bail out the banks and they don't bail out anybody else, you see. So they create this Federal Reserve intermediary. You know, this hybrid institution that appears to look as if it is a government institution, but it is not. Right? There is some government oversight. But it was really created by and for, in 1913, the private banking system. As I said before, the private bankers occupied all the decision-making levels in the central bank. Right? They made all the decisions. The central bank districts and the central bank itself is a corporation. Yes. In other words, the central bank does not get money from the government to run. It's independently financed by the banks. Associated banks in the geographical districts buy stock in the district banks. And they get dividends from that stock, and the bank, federal district banks, earn profits and redistribute it as dividends to its banker affiliates in these districts. Still works that way. So the bankers, the committees that run the district, then select from themselves, there's nine of them, select the president of the district. So the bankers elect their presidents in the district who run the Federal Reserve district banks. This was, you know, in its first phase of the Federal Reserve. Bankers running the banks on behalf of the banks, independent of virtually all government influence at the time. You know, the Federal Reserve Board in Washington was just a token. Make it look like there is some government influence over it. Well, the Federal Reserve, you know, run by the banks, the committees run by the banks, are the banks. I mean, how can they supervise themselves? How do you get bank supervision when you got the banks supervising themselves? You know? If you have no bank supervision, then the banks periodically get into these excess speculative manias, you know, that cause financial crashes. Self-supervision is always a farce. And that's what it was. There was no supervision. Well, why did the government put up with this fiction of federal central banks. Well, because the primary, a primary function and role of central banks is to raise money for the government, you see. They go out there, right, at least, in the early history of the U.S., and they go to their private bankers, you know, all these de facto central banks before 1913. They go out there and they raise money for the government. And the government, of course, likes that. If the government wants to expand its military and its colonies and so forth, then maybe even, you know, provide infrastructure, business infrastructure that private sector markets won't, well, then they're going to get the money somewhere, the government. The government could get the money by taxing the wealthy, but the wealthy don't like that, you see. The wealthy would rather loan the government money and get an interest payment back for those loans than have the government tax them for the money the government needs for wars and colonies and defense and so forth, right? So you get this symbiotic relationship between governments and the central bank as the intermediary to the private banking system. The banking system, through the Federal Reserve, the central bank, aggregates the loans from investors and private banks and gives it to the government. The government pays interest rate back. The central bank serves as the fiscal agent in between, paying bills and taking the money and so forth, you know. So it's convenient to have a central bank in the 20th century and beyond for the government. It's also convenient for the private banks, so long as they control it, the central bank. Because they make money on the loans, and the more you loan the government, the less you have to tax them, you see. They prefer to fund the government through loans because that creates an interest income stream back to them. That's why we see, you know, reductions in taxation on the wealthy and the businesses and corporations trend here for decades now. At the same time, government borrowing has risen as the trend. Interest payments, you see, hundreds of billions of dollars of interest payments on hundreds of billions flow back to the banks and their wealthy investors constantly. Right? It's a profit center. The central bank becomes a profit center for the private banks. And, that's the key institution for modern capitalist economy. And, of course, for modern capitalist governments. You know, it's convenient for both. The government raises funds to do what it wants. And, you know, the private banks and their investors, depositors, make money off of it. That's what central banks do, have done from the very beginning. That was the first function of central banks, raise money for the government, you see. It added other functions along the way, like trying to control the money supply here. Quote, control the money supply, because the whole purpose has been to provide as much money and liquidity, as they call it, to the private banking system so that it can continue to be profitable. Now, since the 1970s, the central banks have over-provided money and liquidity to the private banking system. With the collapse of what was called the Bretton Woods International Monetary System in 1973, central banks were given the role of solely determining, without constraints, the amount of money they wanted to inject into the economy. Before that, there were constraints on how much, but since the collapse of Bretton Woods and neoliberalism, it's been a money fire hose from the central banks to the private banking system and investors. Every excuse, pump more money, more money, more money. Now, when you get that much money fluctuating, you know, within the system, the economy, what it does is stimulate financial asset investing and speculation. And that's why you get a creation of these financial asset bubbles increasingly since the 1970s. There's a mountain of money sloshing around the global economy. And that's been the product of the central banks doing that decades, you know. And that's why interest rates are so low and they can't get them back up. They can't get that money back out of the system, you see. Now, another interesting thing about the Federal Reserve announcement here was Janet Yellen indicated as part of that interest rate hike that the Federal Reserve was going to, in the near future, start selling off its balance sheet. What do we mean, balance sheet? Well, balance sheet is all the debt that the Federal Reserve has been buying from private investors through its QE program and other programs since 2009. Officially, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has purchased about $4.5 trillion of bad assets, subprimes, remember those? And other assets, treasuries, and so forth, from private investors and banks. In other words, the Fed has printed money and given it to these investors and banks. Well, for the banks, it's just electronic entry on the Federal Reserve. But anyway, they've given this free money to them, pretty much, actually subsidized more than free, because we don't know how much the Fed paid for these bad assets, these subprimes, you see. The Fed keeps that old secret. We don't know. Well, I'm sure they paid more than market level rates for a lot of these subprimes because they were virtually worthless, right? So when the Fed pays and buys these bad assets from these investors, it puts it on its accounts, the Fed's accounts, called the balance sheet. And that's why we got $4.5 trillion of purchasing of subprimes and agency debt and mortgages and treasuries and so forth on the Fed balance sheet sitting there, which amounts to, you bail out the private banking system by taking its debts onto your books. See, that's what's happened. This is 2009. And this happened everywhere with central banks. You know, European Central Bank has trillions of dollars on its balance sheets. The Bank of England, I think, 700-800 billion. You know, even the People's Bank of China, you know, trillions. Japan, trillions. So the central banks everywhere have rescued the private banking system by buying up private banking debt and investors' debt, private investors' debt, and putting it on its own books. That's called the balance sheet. Well, the Fed now says, Yellen said here this week, that they're going to start selling that balance sheet. Right? Sell those bad debts back to whoever wants to buy them. And, of course, that will take money out of the economy. Right? Those out there in the economy will buy these debts on Fed balance sheet and give the Fed money. Money will flow out of the economy. Well, if you flow money out of the economy, it's going to raise interest rates. Right? That's why the Fed says, "Oh, we're going to do it so slowly." Janet said this past week that it's going to be like watching paint dry. Right? Only a few billion dollars a month. So it'll be so slow it won't disrupt, won't raise rates. Well, we shall see. I think it will. In any event, they're going to start selling off their balance sheet. We don't know the impact of this, and this will be the first attempt in 30 years to really pull money back out of the economy, the global economy. You know, these trillions and trillions that have been injected that have kept interest rates so low, subsidizing bankers and investors, and boosting financial asset prices, and making investors, the 1%, filthier rich with every year. You see, all this income inequality is a result largely of central bank and government fiscal policy, but central bank monetary policy. If you keep interest rates super, super low for this long, if you subsidize bankers and investors for this long, They got all this excess money, and they start speculating in stocks and bonds and so forth, and they drive up the prices of those financial assets, and they make capital gains of all kinds. And then you let them keep all that capital gains by cutting capital gains taxes, you see. So the money just flows through to their own personal accounts. Well, it makes the 1% filthy, filthy rich as a result. You know, the tax policy and all the excess money from the Federal Reserve driving up financial asset prices, creating bubbles, right? Businesses, what do they do with the very low interest rates? You know, they go and they issue their corporate bonds and get money that way, trillions of dollars. In other words, they're not making profits. They're taking advantage of the super low rates to issue corporate bonds. You got a company like Apple with, you know, over $250 billion in cash, raising more cash by offering corporate bonds because it's so cheap to do it. You're subsidizing these big corporations with these super low rates. And then they pass it through to their shareholders, and their shareholders get to keep it because taxes on dividends and capital gains are reduced. You see, and all that results in a huge run-up in incomes for the 1%. That is why we have, the most important reason why we have this 1% income escalation going on. Now, it's also, income inequality is also a function of the fact that we're not creating real jobs, high-paying jobs anymore. We're creating these part-time temp jobs, and even in some areas, they're disappearing now, like retail, which is all part-time now. Retail's in trouble, at least the big department stores, and they're laying, you know, tens of thousands of people off. The auto companies are going to start laying off tens of thousands as well. General Motors just cut back its productions significantly here in the past week. That's a harbinger, things to come, layoffs coming. Well, when you're not creating real jobs, and real investment, productivity is just about zero. When you're not creating that, wages don't rise. You know, the Fed can't understand why wages aren't rising. Wage incomes aren't rising. You know, to the extent they are rising, it's for the top 10%, you know, salaries and of professionals and middle managers and tech people and so forth. But the rest are just languishing. There's no increases in wages. Real income. Well, that means that most households, median and below households, are borrowing more. They're going further and further in debt just to maintain their basics of their standard of living. And that's why you see auto debt through the roof, student debt through the roof, credit cards rising, right? It's all this debt-based consumption going on because there's no real wage gains and real income gains going on for the bottom 80% of households in the U.S. But the 1% keeps getting filthy rich because of the free money, you see, and all the speculation and financial assets around the globe. They, you know, they buy and sell this stuff around the globe. 1% is getting filthy, filthy rich more and more and more because ultimately, to a large extent, these Fed policies, central bank policies of very, very low interest rates for 8 years, unjustified, 7 years after recovery. They just keep it going because it's such a good deal and because the financialization of the economy has spread into the financialization of the government. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, all the rest, you see. They have a stranglehold now on the political system. And if you think Donald Trump's going to change that, well, just look at who's running his economy. Goldman Sachs, as I said earlier. Nothing's changing with Trump. Right? You're not going to see any job creation with Trump. You know, it's all a farce. It's all for public consumption. Keep feeding all the lies and misrepresentations to the people and hope that they forget. That's what's going on. So, you know, Trump is a neoliberal. In fact, a worse neoliberal we're going to see than even Obama. But they're all from the same cut, I say. And Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve do their bidding. And have been for 8 years. And Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs, ex-president, replaces Janet 6 months from now or 8 months from now, it will be more of the same. Right? Those Fed policies are designed to take care of the bankers and the banking system, because the bankers, the banking system still run the show. Now, it's not as crude as it used to be in 1913, where the bankers actually ran, were the committee members, the nine committee members in each federal district. No, no. In 1935, see, the Fed got into a deep problem. In 1932, it not only didn't bail out the banks, it exacerbated the Great Depression. Why did it do that? How did it do that? Well, if you remember, the Federal Reserve is there, and the central bank is there to take care of the the incomes and interest, economic interests of the wealthy. So what did it do in 1932? Well, instead of bailing out, the banks and stimulating the economy and so forth, it raised interest rates. The Federal Reserve raised interest rates in the depth of the Depression, and that made it even worse. Well, why did they raise rates? Because raising rates was a way of keeping the value of the dollar up, and therefore the value of the bonds and the investments of the wealthy from collapsing, which they already were, you see. So the Federal Reserve in 1932, the bankers, took a short-term view of protecting the value of the investments of their banks and their investors over the long-term effects of what they were going to do by raising rates, and it made things worse. Well, by 1935, it was pretty clear that the Federal Reserve was just a banker institution, and the Roosevelt government enacted some reforms and put the Federal Reserve Bank in the corner. Put a dunce cap on them, said, go sit in the corner. We're going to have my treasury run the show here monetarily for the rest of my term, which is what happened. The Federal Reserve was put in the closet. But not until they made some reforms in the Federal Reserve. What were these reforms? They got a little bit more government appointments of these nine members in the committees that ran the district banks, you see, the 12 district banks. Three of the nine members had to be government appointees from Washington. They strengthened the Washington board of the Fed. The president would appoint a board of governors of seven. And then you have your 12 districts, so you got 19 people running the Federal Reserve Bank, right? 12 district presidents and seven direct appointees by the government. And the government thought that would be sufficient, right? Because the seven would vote, and only a rotation of some of the 12 would get the vote. But they all sit on the same committee, you see, the 19 of the Federal Open Market Committee, making decisions on interest rates. And the federal, the president of the Fed districts is still appointed by the banks, especially the New York Fed, you see. That's the key, the New York Federal Reserve District. And no one gets appointed as the president of the Federal New York District who isn't approved, vetted beforehand by the big banks in New York. That's the key, because that's where all the bonds are bought and sold and so forth, you see. So I'm not going to go in detail on this show, but we'll do it in other shows, how even today the private bankers really indirectly, much more subtly, strategically, not necessarily, every individual rate hike decision, but in terms of strategic direction and so forth, they still run the Federal Reserve. This is a strange institution, you see. It appears to be a sector of the government, but it is not. Right? It is a kind of corporation, a hybrid form of a bank. And it's more private than it is public, On the surface, It's projected as, you know, a government agency that's supposed to regulate the money supply and look at economic growth, you know, and keep inflation down and keep economic growth and jobs growing and so forth, right? That's the spin. That's everything that's presented publicly. But underneath it all, it's really about the private banking system and the private banks. That's what the Fed has always been about. And it's much more subtle and sophisticated now how the private banks really get their interests implemented through the Federal Reserve. I mean, why else would there have been 8 years of zero interest rates? I mean, you know, that's the smoking gun. You know, if the Federal Reserve was really about the rest of us and the rest, ensuring the rest of the economy, why would they have kept interest rates so low for so long when those interest rates weren't attaining any of their targets and objectives? Near zero rates for 8 years, it had failed to raise prices for goods and services. It was raising prices for financial markets, of course, nicely. But for goods and services, it failed, you know, never reached the 2%. And now it's going the opposite direction, right? And that's true of central banks everywhere. They say, oh, 2% price target, you know, in Europe and Japan and so forth. They're nowhere near it. And they keep it going, and they keep using that phony excuse of 2% price level. And then, you know, when they couldn't attain 2% here a couple of years back, they said, oh, well, you know, what we're really trying to do is get unemployment down. Well, they got unemployment down, and they still didn't change. And then they said wage increases, and they didn't get anything, and they still haven't changed. So it's all phony targets. Okay, we'll continue our discussion here, looking at the modern period, the Bernanke Bank, the Greenspan and Bernanke Bank, next week.